Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Sherry Hoyt, and I'm your host. Today I'm talking with Thomas J. Brodeur, author of Faces Behind the Masks, his award-winning YA novel about a 12-year-old boy who dreams of being a superhero. Before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Thomas. Since childhood, Thomas J. Brodeur has been telling stories. Early efforts included drawing his own comics, a skill he honed from grade school through college. In high school, he composed 3 graphic novels and wrote his first short story. His first published novel, Regina Silsby's Secret War, 2004, was nominated for the Scott O'Dell Award for Historical Fiction. Besides writing, Mr. Brodeur managed to graduate college and divert some attention to a multifaceted career. His corporate experience spans several continents and includes motion picture production, computer-aided design, information technology, management, and customer service. He spends his spare time building ships and bottles and dabbling in calligraphy, cartooning, and fine art. He enjoys fixing things, anything from bikes to broken furniture. Home is Florida with his bride of several decades. Faces Behind the Masks was recently honored with 2 top awards in the 2017-2018 ReaderViews Literary Awards, taking home first place in the teen category for kids ages 12 to 16 and the ReaderViews Kids Award for Best Teen YA Book of the Year. For more information on Thomas J. Brodeur and his books, visit his website at www.thomasjbrodeur.org. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been looking forward to talking with you. So what is Faces Behind the Masks about?
Faces Behind the Masks is about a 12-year-old boy, Travis Warnowski, who fantasizes about being a superhero, so much so that it actually starts taking over his life. He's going through situations, and he's more in his fantasy than he is in the real world. And, well, yeah, what's worse is he thinks his Uncle Alex is a superhero, but Travis still can't stand his Uncle Alex. Alex is very grumpy, he's very reclusive, and Travis decides he's going to blackmail his uncle by exposing his secret identity online, until Travis stumbles into Alex's secret hideout and discovers what Alex really does, and it goes way beyond masked heroics. And then Travis can't wait to sign up. He spends the rest of the story trying to convince Alex, you know, you need me to help you with this. I got the idea from a colleague of mine came into my office one day and said, "Have you ever wondered who has the maintenance contract on the Batmobile?" And we spent the next 20 minutes laughing about a superhero having to make a service call. And I thought this would make a terrific story. So I started assembling it and trying to tell it through the eyes of this 12-year-old kid. So it's a very funny look at the superhero lifestyle.
Yeah, it's such a great storyline. It's so unique, and I love how it came about. That's so, it just happened. It just all kind of sounds like it just all fell into place. I'm sure there was a lot more work behind it, but
yeah, it was a little more complicated than that. But yeah, the idea, it's funny where ideas come from. You know, they can just really hit you out of the blue. They can be the product of conversations like that one was, or even dreams, or stuff that you read or come across in the news. Yeah, there's just, I mean, stories are everywhere.
Yeah, it's just kind of recognizing that and knowing what to do with it.
Well, sometimes it takes me a while, too. I mean, like, it took me about 20 minutes before I'm like, ding, whoa, this would make a funny story. And it didn't occur to me right away.
Is Travis the main character? He's your 12-year-old, right?
He's my 12-year-old main character. That's correct. You're seeing the entire story through his eyes. And then, of course, there's his uncle, Alex. Mm-hmm. And we've got a third character who is a television reporter named Leslie Wright. And she's basically getting wind of what's going on and pursuing this story. And their three lives kind of become kind of interlocked as they see the world start to falling apart, as the villain starts trying to take over things. And the three of them have to go out and do the rescuing.
Yeah, I love that. How did you come to write for teens and young adults? Why did you choose that genre?
I started out wanting to write a story for my daughter. I started out when she was about 10 or so in earnest, and I always enjoyed action adventure stories. One of my favorite characters is Zorro, for example. But you don't see too many stories for girls with girl heroines. They're mostly boys. And I wanted to write a story for her with a female protagonist. So I essentially took the Zorro theme and transplanted it into Boston on the eve of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. I wrote her an adventure story. It was called Regina Silsby's Secret War. And it's in the American Revolution, if you'll recall, in Boston, the British are taking over the town, and they're establishing this very heavy military presence, and they're billeting themselves in people's homes and eating mm-hmm. all of their stores and confiscating their property, and they're arresting people and things like that. And suddenly in the middle of this mayhem bursts this terrifying phantom out of the King's Chapel graveyard. Regina Silsby is this woman who died under very mysterious circumstances 30 years before, and all of a sudden up comes her ghost out of the graveyard, and she starts terrorizing the whole town. And every time the British show up to try to do something, she's there and she ruins it for them. And of course everybody's scared to death, wondering what she wants. And the British, of course, are saying, well, it's just a man disguised as a ghost. You know, of course, I want him out there, and I want you to find him, and I want him hanged. And when they finally do catch her, they discover what you, the reader, have known all along. Regina Silsby is actually a teenage girl.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Not a girl. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a girl. Yeah, she's... And I managed to get that one published, actually, and then we did a sequel to it called... Regina Silsby's Phantom Militia, which essentially picks up where the first one leaves off, and that one has Lexington in it and Concord and the Siege of Boston, and you're seeing all this stuff through the eyes of this teenage heroine. It's a very riotous dive into colonial Boston. It's a lot of fun, yeah.
It sounds like a lot of fun, and what I want to know is, how do you get into the character of a 12-year-old girl? How do you get into...
She's about 16 in those stories, but yeah. Well, how difficult is it, really? I mean, we're all kids at heart, you know, and stuff. We have our various enthusiasms and things that pique our interest. And, in fact, frankly, I like telling stories through the eyes of younger individuals because mm-hmm. their reactions are more raw, they're more, you know, out in the open, they're they overreact, you know, they have these explosive emotions, and so seeing it through the eyes of a younger person, you can make a lot more use of the exaggerations. For example, Faces Behind the Masks, I'm looking at this whole thing through a 12-year-old kid, so I've got a lot of very outlandish things happening, but because you're seeing it through his eyes and you're reacting to it with him, it makes it a lot more plausible and a lot more fun. And I think kids also they haven't done all the extra layering, if you will, that an adult learns how to do. So the issues aren't as complicated. They're a lot more black and white. And so the good-evil aspects of, say, a superhero story are a lot more fun when you're looking at them through the eyes of a kid, because all of his reactions are, you know, are huge. And that kind of
thing. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And it's a lot more energetic, too, it seems like, you know, and I guess that kind of helps move the story along.
But at the same time, I don't want to write down to them either. I mean, all of these books of mine have a pretty big vocabulary, mm-hmm. and the sentences and the verbiage or the verbs are, you know, pretty bold and active. So a grown-up would like these books every bit as much as a kid does. Because they're not, I haven't dumbed them down for children, if you will. They're pretty serious stuff for grown-ups, too.
Yeah. So you mentioned that there's a lot of hidden adult humor. It's not really for kids. It's for adults,
That's
too.
True. What I had hoped to accomplish, particularly with Faces, is for a kid to be reading it at age 12, 14, 16, somewhere in that range, and be laughing at it all over the place. But then if they go back and pick it up again, in their 20s, they'll be laughing all over again, but for entirely different reasons. And the book has a lot of that in there. There's stuff that, you know, could kind of go over a kid's head. They'll still be laughing at it and enjoying it, but they'd like it a lot more as a grown-up.
Right. Yeah, that's funny. Now, the cover is very, it's crazy. I love it. Did you draw the cover?
I sketched it out for the artist who did draw the cover. I am an artist, and I could have done something like this, except I don't have time. I need to be writing these stories, so I hired a graphic artist to do the cover for me. You know, I gave them the sketches and told them the color schemes that I wanted, and but they put that together for me, and I came out pretty much exactly the way I was hoping it would look.
Yeah, that's great. So did you know the sketch artist? Because sometimes it's hard to find an artist that would match what you intend.
It can be difficult, but yes, I did know this person. She has her own design studio. It's called Delfino Design Studio, and she's online. And now for the Regina Silsby books, the publisher actually picked that artist. I did the same thing. I gave them sketches and told them the color schemes I wanted, and they put it together from that. But for Faces, yes, I knew the artist and had asked her if she would do this for me and commissioned her to put that together for me. Yeah, we had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah. I just wondered, because with picture books, a lot of times the author doesn't have a lot of say-so in what happens. Mm-hmm. It's like almost like the picture tells a totally different story. Yeah.
I suspect that any probably artist wouldn't enjoy working with me quite so much, because I have a lot of opinions about what I want it to look like. And if it doesn't look like, here, give me it, I'll do it. You know.
Right. Right. I'm curious about your drawing. You say you're a sketch artist, and I was wondering, does drawing inspire your writing, or the other way around, or are they even related?
That is an excellent question, and I would say that, yeah, they both ebb and flow because they're working from the same creative spark. The first attempts I did at storytelling were actually graphic novels that I did when I was in high school, and I continued doing that in college as well. So I'm very visually oriented, and I don't know if you're familiar, there's a book called Drawing from the Right Side of the Brain. Have you heard of that, or do you know anything about that?
No.
I can't remember the author's name, but it's a brilliant book. And her argument is, you know, you've got your left brain, which is the organized part. That's the part that helps you make sense of the world. And we need that. I mean, it's the side of you that says, okay, here's a chair. It's got four legs, it's got a seat, it's got a back, and you sketch that out, that's a chair. The kids use it when they're drawing people. They have little stick figures and little round faces and things like that. But what happens is, as you get older, you know, particularly in the drawing sense, about age 10 or 12, kids are, the left brain is so strong in organizing it that kids come to the wrong conclusion. When they draw a chair and their left brain takes over and they draw four stick legs and a flat top, and they're suddenly looking at it and they're going, you know, that doesn't look like this chair that's sitting in front of me. And their conclusion is, I can't draw, which is not right. The actual part is the right brain is the side that is all the spatial relationships. It's your creative side, and it's the side that can see it. So this book is basically a training ground on how to draw with the right side of your brain. In other words, don't let your left brain demand a chair looks this way. Mm-hmm. The right brain is the one that says, okay, let's look at what's really in front of me and draw that. And you wind up breaking it down into its various components, its various spaces. One exercise they'll have you doing, for example, is if you're looking at a chair, they say, don't draw the chair, draw the space around the chair. In other words, you're drawing all the holes where the chair is not. And so suddenly you're not looking at the chair, you're looking at the various shapes. And as these kids, you know, work in the exercise, start trying to draw the holes, all of a sudden out pops this chair, and it looks like the chair that's in front of them, not their stick figure drawing.
Right.
And as I work with that, I suddenly realize, you know, writing's the same way. We think that a writer sits down and, you know, it starts with an empty page, and we write from page one and work our way through the novel all the way to the end and then finish it. And you have the classic writer's block where all of a sudden, what do I do now? And you have to go wandering around in the middle of the night, you know, with your arms behind your back and your chin in your chest, thinking. And that's your left brain trying to do it. And I do not write that way, and most of the writers I talk to do not write that way. I use a technique which has worked very well for me. I actually learned it in high school. It's called outlining. And the really. I mean,
I thought you were going to tell me about a new technique.
No. This is an old technique, but believe me, it works. And the reason I like it is because it satisfies both sides of the brain. Mm. The outline allows me to organize the story, but I don't have to figure out how my character gets from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. I can hop around all over the story wherever I want to be. So if I suddenly have these flashes of insight for the climax, I don't have to worry about how he gets there. I just plunge in and start writing my climax, and I'll plug it into my outline. If I get snatches of dialogue, which I like, I can get all that down. I mean, you can go pages and pages and pages with this interaction going on, plug it into your outline, and if you wake up in the middle of the night with a great opening line, write it down, and the next day plug that into your outline. Yeah. And so you're organizing all these disparate creative thoughts that as your mind hops around. Eventually, your story starts separating itself naturally into chapters. And from there, you can start looking at the pacing and going, you know what, if I'm going to have this happen over here, I got to start seeding clues for it back in here. Mm-hmm. And if I am wanting to have this tremendous philosophical point, I can start seeding clues for it there. So by the time I get to the main point, my audience is ready to hear it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you're jumping everywhere all over your story, and so the whole thing is all mapped out, your character development, how I intend to display character. You don't tell them how a person is. You show it with their gestures and their actions and their thinking and stuff like that. For example, in Regina Silsby's Secret War, the heroine, her name is Rachel Winslow, and how do I show that she's a brave girl? I do it by putting her with a timid friend. So in the very beginning of the book, these two girls are walking by this spooky graveyard, and the girl's going, you know, don't go near there. You know, you've heard the story. The spirits are going to come out, and they're going to grab us into the grave with them. And Rachel's sitting there going, oh, for heaven's sake, are we going to be any safer on this side of the road than that side? That kind of thing. You see,
right.
So Rachel's brave. And I use that stuff for later on. So by the time you actually start writing, a lot of the heavy lifting is already done. And really, my first draft is done. It's very rough, but it's done. I know where I'm going. And then I just start cleaning it up. And then I can start at the beginning and work my way through it.
Yeah. I think I know I have that problem. Just trying the perfectionism overrides any kind of creativity I try and have. Like if I look at that blank page, it's daunting.
It can be, but and you're right, too, because I tend to slip into wanting to say it perfectly up front, too. So I have to constantly fight that urge to get it right. If I'm in draft mode, if you will, I'm just looking for raw reactions and imagery. I have to fight to not write good sentences unless one pops into my head. If I have a certain way I want to phrase something, I'll put it in there. I may even make a note to myself, you know, have dialogue about, you know, X or Y, and then move on. And then later on when I'm doing the cleanup stuff, then I start trying to polish it. And if you can allow yourself the permission, if you will, to jump and just insert your various sections into your outline, you will find not only that it goes faster, but also you don't run into the writer's block.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast talking with published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experiences as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available through direct podcast as well as MP3 download from your computer for your convenience. Please visit us at InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Thomas J. Brodeur, author of Faces Behind the Masks. For more information on Thomas and his books, visit his website at www.thomasjbrodeur.org. Now, do you have a writing routine? Do you write every day?
I wish I could say that I do, but I have other responsibilities. I do have a regular job that I work, and I take care of my family, of course. But again, all of these various responsibilities have to be worked in together so that you do have a nice steady diet of activity too, I guess you might say. In other words, I think the creative process relies on other things too. For example, my job actually gives me a rest from the writing discipline. Mm-hmm. And the writing gives me a vacation from the job. So they both kind of play on each other.
Yeah.
So I do try to write several times a week. And I find, too, that having large chunks of dedicated time for writing are necessary, say 3 or 4 hours.
Mm.
Anything less than that. And sometimes you really can't get into the zone. But you're right, it is a discipline because, frankly, every time you sit down to write, you have to get over that hump of, A, I don't feel like doing this today, or B, I can't do this. It's always going to be there. I remember one seminar I was giving when somebody asked me, what is the hardest thing about writing? And my answer was starting.
Yeah.
That's going to be true with just about anything you do. The hardest part is putting that first foot forward.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, how important do you think reading is as it relates to writing?
Huge, absolutely huge. I am constantly reading fiction and nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
They both fuel your mind. You know, your brain needs stimulation. It needs input in order to process. And I don't think that a person needs to experience everything. In other words, if I'm going to write a book about a drug addict, I don't have to become a drug addict to understand what addictive behaviors feel like. I mean, you know, and you can do a lot of studying, too, and I think that so nonfiction is big because that's where you can get some of your fuel from. But reading other writers' fiction is big as well because it's a big help to see how other people do it.
And mm-hmm.
I think it's possible to learn from bad examples as well as good ones. I think one of the problems with reading really, really good writers is you go so swept up in their writing that you forget you're trying to study it too, and you just move along, and you suddenly, oh, I forgot, I needed to figure out. You know, you lose track of why it's good.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're reading somebody that's not so good, then all the things you learn about don't do this and don't do that, they suddenly jar you out of the story, and you're like, okay, that's why I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
So you can learn from both.
And it's true what you said. I think it's definitely different reading as a writer or versus reading for pleasure, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
you know? So,
absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I find that it's hard for me to read for pleasure, quote unquote, anymore because I'm always studying it.
Mm.
So, I mean, some of them are fun, but it's far more pleasurable, too, when you're reading somebody who does it well because you're enjoying it on multiple levels. You're enjoying the storyline, but you're also enjoying how they do it. And some folks are just brilliant at it, and they're always fun to look at.
Yeah. Who are some of your favorite authors, and what do you like to read?
Oh, boy. I enjoy reading everything, anything I can get my hands on. Some of my favorite writers, though, I've always enjoyed Arthur Conan Doyle. His Sherlock Holmes stories are marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
And he just builds a plot line so very well, and the way he presents his cases and stuff is always fun.
Yeah.
I think Ken Follett is good. His pacing is excellent, how he draws you into his stories. I've always enjoyed Alistair MacLean. Remember Alistair MacLean, The Guns of Navarone, and some of the adventures that he used to write? I mean, his stuff was just terrific, and it's such succinct prose, but very active. He does a marvelous job of, you know, really throwing into the action of the thing quickly and vividly. I've always enjoyed him.
Do you read any young adult novels?
I have read some of them. Of course, I read the Harry Potter series, and I read Rick Riordan's, you know, Percy Jackson, The Olympians, and some of those. I like, you know, seeing what other folks are doing out there. You know, one of the things I, for example, wanted to do with Faces Behind the Masks was, you know, avoid the magical stuff. I think that there's a lot of push to try to do those kinds of fantasy things, and I mean, that's got its place, and I like that, but I mean, I want to partially deal with the real world too, even though I'm dealing with superheroes.
Yeah.
I think that I want it to be real too. I want these kids to realize, you know, you're capable of doing this right where you are right now, and you don't have to be able to fly or be invisible or things like that. You have within you already what it takes to be super. And so I was.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
I was very conscious of trying to put that in front of my readers.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I love that. Now, you independently published, right?
For Faces Behind the Mask, yes, I did. The two Regina Silsby's books were published by Journey Forth in South Carolina. And Faces Behind the Masks, I went independent for that one.
Mm-hmm.
I like the having a little more control over it.
Yeah, and is that the biggest difference? What I'm sure there are pros and cons to each. How did you find going the independent route?
Well, I didn't find it all that difficult. I frankly went to a community college here locally where I live in Florida, and just basically took a course on how to get your book published online. And they essentially walked us through all the stuff you need to do and what you need to watch out for and how to get your own ISBN numbers and the copywriting procedure and how to upload and on and on and on and on. And I took copious notes and then thought, okay, I think I can do this. And here I am fanning through the pages now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot faster process, I imagine.
Yeah, it is, and again, you have a little bit more control over it. I think the only difficulty I would say that I miss would be the extra set of professional eyes you have from an editor and a literary agent. Those are luxuries I did have with the Regina Silsby series that you lose if you're doing it independently. So if you don't have some kind of a trusted group of people, let's say a writer's group or someone with enough editorial experience, it can be a problem because, you know, nobody, well, like one of Hannibal's generals once said to him, God gives many gifts to many men, but he never gives one man all of them. So I may be able to write a story, but there are holes in it that, you know, you don't see. And somebody, have you ever thought about this? Or, well, how does this guy get from there? Right, okay, I better, you know, that's, you need other people looking at it.
Yeah. So do you have a critique partner or someone that you use to bounce those ideas off
of? The best person who's ever helped me critique my stuff actually is my own daughter.
Oh.
She is wonderfully gifted herself in terms of writing and arrangement. She's got a fabulous creative streak, so I love putting my stuff in front of her and going, hey, who you gonna think of this? And as a matter of fact, I ask her advice on a lot of things now.
Yeah.
You know, my wife and I will sit there going, wrestling over some issue, and we'll be going, oh, I don't know what to do. Well, why don't we better ask Michelle, maybe what she thinks. So, but, yeah, she's a big help to me.
Yeah, that's great. What do you like to do when you're not reading and writing and working? You have a lot of hobbies. Talk about
them. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I love to, you know, fix things. I'm constantly fixing everything from bicycles to broken furniture to, you know, building stuff. I love working with wood. I actually used to build flintlock firearms, you know, Kentucky rifles, you know, Daniel Boone type stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to build those. I build ships in bottles. I've been doing that since I was 17.
Now, explain a little bit of that process to me, because I've always wondered, like, how does the ship get in the bottle? Do you build it inside the bottle? How does that happen?
That is the fun of it, isn't it? Yeah. Well, it's not too difficult. First of all, I started doing it the summer after I had graduated high school. I was wandering around the house. Of course, school's done. I'm not working this one day. All of my chores are finished, and I'm wandering around the house wondering what to do to relieve my boredom. And it suddenly popped into my head, I'll build a ship in a bottle. I had never seen one, but that didn't stop me. I ran down to the local library, and I found a book on how to build ships in bottles.
Huh.
And that book taught me how to build a very simple two-masted schooner and get it into the bottle. And once I was so pleased with the result. It really came out very well. I was very happy, but the more I looked at that model, the more I started thinking, you know what, that's not, I've always loved ships. I've been very nautical. I've been a sailor. Mm-hmm. I love boats. So I'm looking at this thing and realize, you know, those masts are too fat, the hull's too narrow, the sea, that's, you know, the putty that's making up the sea is kind of sloppy, you know. I try it again. And so I made a second one and a third one and a fourth one, and then I started thinking, I wonder if I could build a square rigger, you know, the one that has the yard arms hanging perpendicular to the mast, a clipper ship type thing.
Oh, my God.
And then I started putting in little gun ports and doing the more ornate sterns and that kind of thing. Pretty soon I'm building these scale models of famous ships, but the models are 4 inches long. But, I mean, in fact, if you look at that, my offer photo on my website, it's thomasjbrodeur.org. I've got one of my bottled ships in that picture. And it's a model of the USS Constitution.
I did. I saw that photo. It's amazing. It's just fascinating to me.
Well, it is a lot of fun, and they're all over my house now, and I've given them as gifts to people, and you almost fear that they're going to lose their appeal, because, again, you go into my house, and there's at least two or three in every single room.
It's your new decorating style.
Well, it is, yeah. I've got friends, you know, who are constantly bringing me bottles. Hey, I thought this might be worth putting a ship in it, and then, so, yeah, I've got a collection out there I need to figure out what to do with, too, so, yeah.
Yeah.
I enjoy the big ones especially because you don't see large bottles very often. So like the one in that photograph, that's I think it's like a gallon, I believe. It's a large bottle, but that's the fun of it is you don't get to see too many that are big. And then I have another one which is a wine bottle. It's a bulb, maybe about 4 inches in diameter, but the neck is 18 inches long. It's this big, long neck, then suddenly, bloop,
oh,
down,
wow,
this ball-shaped bottle.
Yeah.
And I managed to get something down into that, but that's a long trip through the neck before it gets into the bottle itself.
That's so interesting. You're very creative. So.
Well, yeah, my wife has called my brain the biggest storehouse of useless information she has ever come across.
Now, you also like to travel, right?
We've done a lot of traveling. When we were younger, I had a job. My job took me overseas, actually, for a while. We were stationed in the Middle East for about 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And so, well, yeah, it was wonderful. I loved it. It's just absolutely fascinating part of the world.
Yeah.
And from there, we did a lot of traveling because you're close to Europe, you're close to Asia. When we traveled home, you'd literally go around the world. You'd head east and come home to the States and then continue heading east and stop somewhere in Europe on the way back. So we were able to do a lot of things. And again, that's just wonderful fuel for the imagination and the intrigue of, you know, various stories that happen in various locales. And you just kind of file it away and think, you know, I might be able to use that someday. And that's the fun thing about storytelling is you're constantly just pulling information from everywhere and assimilating it and throwing it together and then creating your characters and throwing into these situations and watch what they do.
Yeah, that's true. Just to experience the different cultures, that just opens up like a whole new avenue. Yeah.
Well, it's marvelous because the you know, so much of our outlook is European. And in the Middle East and the Far East, their philosophical, the way they look at life is completely different. And it's just fascinating to see it and to learn how to understand that frame of mind and see how they view the world. It's very different.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it was. We had a lot of fun.
So what's your next project?
I'm working on the sequel to Faces Behind the Masks right now. In fact, I'll probably be getting back into it after you and I finish talking. The sequel is called Mission Preposterous, and it's about, well, I'm taking the same characters. I've got Travis and Leslie Wright and Alex, but this one is got more of the flavor of a James Bond spoof. I'm taking them on this adventure, which has them hopping around various corners of the globe while they're chasing around this nebulous villain who eventually we learn the climax at the end, what he's after in his scheme to take over the world, and then we have to stop it, of course. You know, I think it's funnier than Faces Behind the Masks myself.
Oh, great. So I guess it might be too early to tell, but do you intend a series?
Well, I know I've got at least two, and I've got thoughts for a third, but I have some other projects I want to work on as well. Would be a different sets of characters. And again, I don't want to go into too much detail because
right.
I don't want to blow my ideas. Otherwise, I'll see them on a billboard next week somewhere. I've got enough stories to last me the rest of my life.
That's awesome. That's mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like to end every interview with the same question, and that is, do you have any advice for aspiring authors?
Yeah, one is be mindful of the ideas floating around you. Their ideas are everywhere. The problem for most of us is, you know, when we're sitting around the lunchroom with our friends and we're going, wouldn't it be great if this or that happened? There are the ideas for a story right there. The problem is most of us just let them fade away into the air.
Mm-hmm.
Write them started.
And
that happens. That's a necessary courage every single day, even if you're experienced at it.
Yeah, yeah. That's great advice. Thomas, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
To our listeners, thank you for joining me today on Inside Scoop Live for my interview with Thomas J. Brodeur. To learn more about Thomas and his books, visit his website at www.thomasjbrodeur.org. And don't forget to check out our other interviews at InsideScoopLive.com.